Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Like you said, my name is Ramiro Lobo. I'm a farm advisor with the University of California Cooperative Extension in San Diego County. And today I'm going to tell you a little bit about dragon fruit. We've been playing with it for the last 12, 14 years or so. And very excited about what's happened over this past 12 years and about the prospects for this crop. So I guess being first, I get to take more time than I... I won't be rushed out the door, huh? Out the podium. But just as an overview, I'll kind of give you a brief review of dragon fruit production worldwide. And then we narrow it down to where we are in California and tell you what's going on in San Diego County. And specifically the Southern California coastal counties, which is where dragon fruit has a lot of potential for commercial growing. Then we're going to talk about some opportunities, why we are looking at dragon fruit, some challenges for the industry, what we've done to address some of the challenges that are kind of within the realm of the kind of work we do, and then tell you a little bit about prospects and closing comments. Dragon fruit is pretty much worldwide. The flags on the map showed you areas where there is documented commercial production or where there's been interest in getting into it. Southeast Asia, by far, the cluster in Southeast Asia is where most of the production is happening. And we cannot even get acreage in San Diego County really fine-tuned, so it's kind of hard to tell you how many acres are planted in Southeast Asia, but it is supposedly in hundreds of thousands, more than 100,000 acres today, and still growing. And so I'll kind of touch on each one of those regions a little bit and tell you a little bit and show you some photos of how they are growing them. Because one of the things that we're realizing in our Southern California environment is that we know that there are many ways to skin a cat, right? So there are different growers that are growing dragon fruit using different production systems, trellis systems, and different techniques in many ways. And they are all being successful in their own ways. So there are many ways to do this. And so take that in mind as we go through the photos. Southeast Asia, Vietnam is reported to have more than 100,000 acres planted, and it is the number one exporter of dragon fruit to the U.S. For the most part, they've been exporting, they've been sending us white flesh varieties. And usually, it used to be that most of their fruit came in, and the dragon fruit is a summer fruit, with the season in Southern California going from June till late November, sometimes into January, depending on weather. And Vietnamese, since they grow mostly white flesh dragon fruit, those varieties tend to have a very compact season. I mean, usually within 6 weeks, you harvest 80 to 90% of your crop. And so they used to flood the market, you know, mid-August to mid-September. So if you were in Southern California growing white flesh varieties, you couldn't give them away. I mean, the market was really flooded with those. And it still is today because a lot of our domestic white flesh production happens within that window. So they have a tremendous impact on domestic prices. And now what they've done is they've been using lights and a lot of season extension technologies so that their season is kind of extended on both ends of the spectrum. So they are coming in early. It's almost like a year-round supply of Vietnamese fruit in the market today. So, again, they are by far the exporting country that has a bigger impact in our prices here domestically. So other countries in Vietnam, we look at Thailand with about 7,500 acres, Malaysia, 1,200, China, Indonesia, Taiwan, Philippines, India, they are all reported or I have some contact with people or advisors who are assisting growers trying to get into dragon fruit production in those countries. Central America and Mexico, Nicaragua is by far the main producer and pretty much the main exporter out of Central America as well. They shipped about 200,000 boxes last year, but most of their fruit went to the eastern seaboard. Just this year, they started shipping some fruit into the L.A. wholesale market, but we don't know what that volume is. Mexico, they are starting to pick up a little bit. There is some production in the Yucatan Peninsula, and then I've talked to some people trying to grow them in the Culiacan, Sonora desert area, and we'll see where that goes. Then there is some acres in Costa Rica, El Salvador, in Honduras as well. So this is Nicaragua. You can see that they use it for soil conservation as well. They terrace the hillsides and then they plant them for controlling to control erosion. This is a more technical plantation, although these plants are tremendously big for my liking as a commercial crop. Valuable crop in Nicaragua, they harvest it green because if the grower doesn't, somebody will harvest for them. They will steal the fruit from the vines, from the plants. And since they use it mostly for refreshments and sorbets and ice creams, the sugar level, actually, they prefer it to be slightly acidic. But they mainly work with red flesh varieties in Nicaragua. Colombia and Ecuador, they've sort of picked up the action right now. Colombia's been famous for the yellow pitahaya or Hylocereus megalanthus. And as a matter of fact, it is known as Colombian pitaya just because it originated out of Colombia. Ecuador has gotten a lot of attention lately. There is a region in Ecuador called Palora, and apparently they have a line of a selection of the megalanthus species that produces a really good-sized fruit, which has been the major problem for production here in the States, is that the fruit is really small. I mean, rarely ever makes it to 250 grams without hand pollination. So it is a challenge. But the great thing about this is that it is an off-season crop in Southern California, so if somebody could learn to grow this fruit well, I think there is some money that could be made because it fruits is a longer growing season for the fruit. Takes about 150 to 180 days, whereas the other varieties, from bloom to harvest, they take about 40 days. So it's a much longer season, but it comes out in November, December into March, which is a good season for tropical fruit in the continental U.S. So this is a pack coming out of Ecuador, and you can see the fruit looks really beautiful. It's a beautiful looking fruit, and it's by far the sweetest of them all. Bricks-wise, they usually top 21 on the brick scale, so that makes it really attractive to people who like sugar, that is. Other producing countries, Israel, they do, the pitahaya cultivation as a commercial crop as we know it had the stars in Israel. In the mid-80s, they scouted pretty much America, the American continent, looking for succulents or cacti to look for crops that were drought tolerant, that could have some potential for their farmers in Israel. So they planted a collection of cacti and succulents in the Negev desert, and dragon fruit is one of those plants that they started there. And it's been growing it quite successfully, although it never took off the way they would have liked it. That said, though, they've done a lot of work, really good work developing hybrids, doing crosses, a lot of breeding. And the photo here represents, I think, is a variety called Desert King, which is a hybrid of that they've created. Those are proprietary varieties, and so we haven't really included them in our research plots in California. And they grow in shade houses, but they do. Spain and Portugal, I've had conversations with people, the southern part of the state, Malaga, you know, where they grow Hass avocados and chirimoyas, they are growing quite a bit, you know, a little bit of dragon fruit as well. Same thing with Morocco, talk to people in South Africa and Australia, and they're all, I mean, they're speaking up, a lot of action. For us in California or the U.S., how many of you know Paul Thompson? Paul Thompson was one of the founding members of the California Rare Fruit Growers, which is an organization of plant aficionados that has been responsible for the introduction of a number of crops to backyards in California, and many of those crops have really found their way to commercial growing. As a matter of fact, a lot of large growers, they don't like to admit it, but they sort of join rare fruit growers in a way, sort of spy, scout what's going on, you know, see what's coming down the pipe. And a lot of them pick up ideas from this group. So they've done a fantastic work. So he's considered the father of dragon fruit cultivation as we know it in the U.S. today. And a lot of the hybrids or the varieties that are being grown today are the result of Paul Thompson's breeding work. Without knowing, he passed away a few years ago. Lately, Ed Valdivia has been a really great enthusiast for the crop, promoting it and talking about it, and whatever opportunity he has, he's been promoting the crop and written up several articles in the LA Times, so he's kind of created some awareness. How many of you have tried dragon fruit? Most of you. How many of you tried a white flesh variety the first time you tried it? Most everyone. How was the experience? Eh? I agree with that. So most people's first experience with dragon fruit is with a white flesh variety. And, I mean, there are several reasons for that. I mean, some of it is genetics, but for the most part, it's a post-harvest issue. And it's a management practice that the flavor can be improved tremendously if you do things right. So we've evolved from here to here, and then there is a lot of shades in between. Very low on the Brix scale, usually around 12, 14 max. Very low acidity. So you harvest this fruit late. The fruit loses the acidity. There is no acidity to counter what little sugar is in it. So you get what kind of a flavor? Bland. Nothing. This, on the other hand, is a very acid fruit. You afford to let it go to full color because they have a lot of acid. So the less acid they have, the higher the sugar. The sugar on this is about 16, 16 and a half on average across the board on the Nicaraguan selections. And so you let them go to full color, then you have a better expression of flavor. Plus the flavor in this is more complex. I mean, it's not just about sugar. It's really it stimulates your palate. So there are a lot of hybrids in between that are the sweetest ones, except for the Colombiana species that I talked about. So you get the physical graffiti, a lot of hybrids that usually in the 18 to 19 Brix scale. And those are really instant gratification. It's a burst of sugar. You bite into them, boom. It's like eating a watermelon almost, it's really a burst of juice and sweet water. So U.S. production, again, these are guesstimates, limited to about 1,000 to 1,800 acres. Talked to Jonathan Crane in Florida trying to get a number, and I mean, in the range, it's like 500 to 1,000 acres here in Southern California. We kind of do the same. And so it's a challenge because a lot of people who are doing this kind of like to do it in anonymity. They don't, it's kind of agriculture is a cultural business, so they don't want to let anybody else know they are doing it. But we estimated at about 1,800 acres on the upper end. Early production, mostly white fresh varieties, but the market is certainly turning red. And I said red because red means a lot of things to different people in the dragon fruit industry. People talk about selling reds, and then you see the fruit that is light pink, almost white. So we got to define what red means, but usually it's any color variety. Anything but white is usually preferred by consumers because they tend to be a lot sweeter. Florida production, because of the water table, water being so shallow, people tend to grow them either in berms or in pots. And this is a farm that I don't think is in functioning anymore, Roger Washington's farm in Homestead. He was one of the early growers. The early growers in Florida, and he's no longer farming, I think. The planting on the right is the Red Dragon Fruit Company in South Florida. They were planting. They had a block of about 40 acres, trying to go to 100. So we're seeing larger blocks being put in the ground, which is a good indicator. This is another block of a white flesh variety. These are all reds. You look at Hawaii. This farm is just south of Captain Cook. This is Megalanthus. Brad Hunter is the grower. This is a George Peavy's farm in Captain Cook as well. This is another grower in Captain Cook. And they mainly produce the yellow pitahaya here, the Colombiana, the Colombian type, or this hybrid. And this is called Frankie's Red. It's a neon pink color, really translucent pink, really beautiful flesh color fruit, and really tasty, as tasty as the Colombian pitahaya. So California, when I started my research project, we had this is Bienua Farms in northern San Diego County. They were growing dragon fruit in controlled environment in portable hoop houses at the time, and it was one of the earlier growers. As a matter of fact, I got two varieties from them, and I just named them Bienua White and Bienua Red, just because they were unnamed varieties. This is a photo of our research plots. We're comparing trellis systems, from a single spalier type trellis to a single post trellis. This is on a 10x3 spacing. This is on a 10x6. And trying to give growers options depending on the topography of the farms that they have.
This is a commercial grower in San Diego County. He designed his own trellis system. This is in Fallbrook. This is another grower that sort of emulates the system, another grower using wood. And this is one of the most recent plantings in Bonsall, which is a perfect microclimate for a lot of different varieties. So we're seeing a lot of, like I said, a lot of action, and more people are planting in. I've heard people talking about putting in 100 acres or whatever, so we don't know whether that's, you know, that they, those plants go on the ground or not. As far as what varieties are popular, these varieties, I would say this group of varieties here is pretty much what's being put in the ground, what's being planted. Physical graffiti is by far the horse of the industry in Southern California. It is the most prolific, hardier, tasty variety. Second to that, we tell people to put in a mix of varieties, two or three at least. So we recommend Lisa, which is a Nicaraguan selection, a polyrhizus. And the reason is it outperformed all the other Nicaraguans, but there is a group of Nicaraguan selections that do that are very similar in terms of taste. Vietnamese giant has been also a staple, but again, you know, we instead of these, we recommend another white flesh variety, which is called Soul Kitchen, that came out of a Pine Island, and the reason is it's got a longer season, so you match the bloom cycles of the other varieties. The Light is a creation of Paul Thompson, and so is what is this? American Beauty. This is a Guatemalan selection. And then El Grullo is an accession that I collected in Mexico in the state of Jalisco. What happened with Paul Thompson's hybrid, Paul used a nomenclature S1, S2, S3, or G1, G2, G3, and then some people out of Florida came to San Diego, collected everything they could, took him down to Homestead, and then they had got a group of people together, had a party, and decided, okay, let's name varieties. So I don't know what was going on there, but the names that came out were American Beauty, Haley's Comet, Voodoo Child, L.A. Woman, Cosmic Charlie, Purple Haze, help me, yeah. So again, you know, it must have been fun, but that's what the names came from. And they are really creative names. I mean, they are kind of sticky. So since I got a lot of my plants from them, I retained those names. Get a lot of criticism for not using Paul Thompson's name, but I said, you know, I never got a plant from Paul Thompson himself, so I'm using whatever the nursery name variety is. Now, why pitahayas or dragon fruit? For us in Southern California, our most critical input today in agriculture is water. We've demonstrated that the soil environment, you can modify it, you can amend it, you can go soilless, you can do a lot of different things to grow plants, but you cannot grow things without water. Avocados and citrus have been our main crops, to the tune of 25,000 acres of avocado, 15,000 acres of citrus, and those numbers are declining rapidly because of the water price. San Diego County, where I am, has the highest price, I would say, for agricultural water pretty much worldwide. We pay about $1,200 an acre foot. So with those prices, it's very hard to grow crops that are water intensive and or that don't have a high return on you know, per unit of water applied, which is also another measure of efficiency that I hope you guys start looking at. Looking at efficiency in terms of water use or yield per unit of water as opposed to yield per acre. Because, again, water is our critical input. So it's got great potential as a drought-tolerant crop. We can grow dragon fruit. We've got some irrigation trials going, and we've seen that we can grow it with about a third of the water needed to grow avocados, which is avocados take about 4.5 acre feet. Dragon fruit can be grown with about 1.5, maybe 2. It is a cactus. You can keep him alive with marginal amounts of water, but if you want to grow fruit, want him to produce fruit successfully, you got to increase that water. So we're trying to fine-tune that requirement, but we think that it's got great potential in that regard. It is a fresh market fruit. It is a dessert item. You can great appeal because of the color of the flesh. You see them at high-end restaurants, you know, serve as a dessert, really. And so it is a high-value fruit in that regard. And partly what's driving the demand is it is considered a superfood. There is a lot of health benefits that are attributed to it, high antioxidant activity. In Colombia, they actually sell the Colombian pitahaya as a digestive aid. as a cure for constipation. I don't know if we can use that as a marketing strategy here in the States, but that's what I've heard that they promoted for in Colombia. So I don't want to touch that. In Mexico, I've heard people saying it helps with blood pressure. Some people say that it helps them with Parkinson's. So a lot of anecdotal things that probably the medical industry will look into that and see what I say. And there may be some truth to this, because I've had a company out of France contact me about wanting to source 1,000, 1 ton of dried dragon fruit blossom. So, I mean, they wanted to do a medical trial, I guess, for blood pressure disease. The other thing is got some potential for the processed food industry. The red flesh varieties, that pulp imported from Nicaragua, has been used in the processed food industry as a colorant for people with allergies to red 40. I've done some trials with some people in Southern California use it as a dye for yarn for the organic trade, and it does produce some really great colors. But again, that's kind of out of industrial uses, out of our league. And hopefully, as the fruit gets more established, people will look more into those. Great potential for value added. We make killer ice cream out of it. Smoothie, you probably see now in the market, smoothie packs available from a company called Pitaya Plus out of Nicaragua. Refreshments. We recently had a grower, we had a tasting of a wine made out of dragon fruit, and excellent. I mean, it's probably it was drinkable. Makes great chips if you freeze dry it, chewy bars, and a lot of different snacks. The other thing is, it makes a great landscape plant. So it's easy to get people to grow them, and then you expand the market potential for it because it is a drought tolerant, very adaptive. It will grow on whatever structure you make it available, make available for the plants to grow. And that's why when some neighborhoods in Southern California, just about every one of them, you will see a dragon fruit plant sticking out of their fence, especially in Orange County, Westminster, the Costa Mesa area. The other thing is that current demand certainly exceeds, supply. How long that's going to be the case, we don't know. I mean, this is a we don't know how shallow the market is going to be. But if it is, as deep as the market for blueberries, we are really excited about the potential with this plant because we wish we had a crop like blueberries every 10 to 20 years. It's been a great story for us in California. Challenges. One of the biggest things is the lack of organization industry-wide. There isn't, growers are not organized, so, I mean, they tend to cannibalize each other, a lot of price cutting, so there isn't any communication going on between growers. There is also a great need for research. When we started this project, the only question we had was, will these plants grow in Irvine without me having to sing to them? We found out 1 year into the project that they all grew, and 2 years later we found out that they could all produce fruit without hand pollination, which was another limiting factor at the time. But then the growers that we were impressing in year one become more and more sophisticated and come up with more and more questions, so the number of questions just explode, and then your research dollars just shrink to the point of zero. And so you end up with a lot of questions that are unanswered and no money to do the research. Plus, it is a long-term perennial crop, makes it hard to come up with quick answers. But we keep trying. Infrastructure needs, there are hardly any packers really dealing with dragon fruit. Not only packers, but a lot of the buyers don't want to touch with it, don't want to play with it because the price point is still too high. I mean, they're putting in $3 to $5 a pound, to get into the market. They think it is too high risk, too much risk for a new item. But we're seeing more and more people getting involved with it, and hopefully that will change as more growers get into it as well, or some sort of a cooperative gets organized. A lot of standards as far as quality go, I mean, we keep talking about quality, but we don't really have quality well defined in terms of what is the external quality, what is the sugar base minimum for the fruit, and those have to be worked out once the industry, I guess, gets organized. Pack sizes we see in the market now, depending on the season, are 6 pound pack, a 10 pound pack, or a 20 pound pack. A 10 pound pack is usually about 9 pieces of fruit that you see in the marketplace. And then competition. I mean, we're seeing more and more fruit competing for the market.
And most people who grow this type of specialty items worldwide, they have the U.S. market as a destination, as a target. So it's only continued to increase. So other challenges that we're seeing is a lack of commercial varieties. A lot of varieties are promoted as superior, tasty. I've never seen a crop where just you have, quote-unquote, breeders being as productive as it is with dragon fruit. You know, they get a cutting from someone, they name it. They like it, they name it after the daughter, the mother, the sister, whoever they like really well. And if they don't like it, I guess mother-in-law comes handy, you know. But I mean, a lot of new varieties. So it's been a challenge in that regard because reliability on plant material is very questionable. The other thing is, so we started out to evaluating about 20 different varieties. And this is our field trial in year two in Southern California. Those are the some of the varieties in range of color on the varieties that we had, and they all fruited without hand pollination. The thing is, we had about, all in all, we have about 60 accessions in this field plot, so there is plenty of pollen available for bees to do the work and maybe other insects. So I think a lot of naturally occurring cross pollination is happening. That's we started out as a replicated trial, you know, 4 reps, randomized complete block, but because plants were dying, the quality of the data we were pulling out, I mean, we were replanting, before we didn't know gophers were going to like them, so gophers shoot up, about half of them, the minute we put them in the ground, so we were planting and planting and planting, and could never really have a good quality data to compare. So, but we kind of took averages, and you can see we assess them for hardiness, for color, well, the color of the skin and flesh, cold hardiness, heat tolerance, average weight per fruit in grams, brick scores, and as you can see, physical graffiti outperformed most everything, and then it was followed by Soul Kitchen, which is a white flesh variety, and then Day to Harvest. Today, I wouldn't recommend anybody grows this fruit without considering hand pollination. Because we will look at the, we've done the economic analysis, and it pays to hand pollinate. Plus, the difference between a 1 pound fruit, aka $3, and a dried flower on the ground is only about 5 seconds. You know, that takes you to stab a flower with pollen, you know. So it's a very simple thing, and I'm a believer that there's got to be a premium on farmer skill as well. I mean, if everything was so easy, then why bother? So I take that to heart, and people keep glamoring. We need a hand pollinate, a self-fertile, self-pollinating variety. And I say, the minute that happens, this industry is going to go down the drain. I mean, because everybody's going to have that variety, and then what's going to be the point in growing it? The varieties we were 2 minutes. The varieties we were growing had a lot of confusion in terms of varieties. So we looked at the DNA and pretty much narrowed it down to 7 different genotypes, which line up really well with the geographic origin of the varieties of the source. So we are planning to use these. Hopefully, down the road, we'll start some breeding program and start looking at characteristics of the varieties that we have. And hopefully we'll continue that research if we get the money. Pests and diseases. Cactus virus X is a major challenge to the industry, and it is rampant. I mean, it is in Florida. It is everywhere. And what's happening is we don't know. I mean, and we've been passing it on to growers as well as we've given out cuttings and buying, selling, trading cuttings. And we need to clean up, to produce virus-free plant material so that we do quality research from here on out, because the virus in isolation, we don't know what it does, but it does impact, you know, how plants perform in the, you know, under other adverse climatic conditions. Let's see here. I mean, it's cactus virus X, nematodes. They are also, we were seeing some plants dying in the field and looked at nematodes, and we found out that they are susceptible. So we have a poster 236. In display for you guys to check out if you want to look at nematode work, competition from imports. Let me show this real quick. Price has gone from $9.99 to $3.99 in the market. So you can see that there has been a sharp decline from over the years. So in terms of prospects, it's a great potential, high value, dollar
farm gate prices, $1.50 to $3 a pound, $6 to $9 at retail. A strong preference for a color fruit. We believe the market will segment and people will buy this by variety, just because people buy dragon fruit by for different reasons. Organization and standards are a must, and quality and flavor is our locality are our main selling points. With that, we'll stop and thank you for your time.